Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Hello and welcome back. I'm so glad you could join us today for, well, for a real deep dive. We're tackling Amitav Ghosh's epic novel, Sea of Poppies.
It's a huge book in every sense.
It really is. It's the first part of his Ibis trilogy, and it just plunges you into this world of colonialism, identity, the opium trade.
Mm-hmm.
It's powerful stuff.
Absolutely. It makes you rethink that whole period.
So let's unpack this incredible story, see what it tells us about history, and maybe even about today.
Sounds good. What always gets me is how Ghosh sets it in 1838 and just masterfully connects all these different lives, people who seem worlds apart.
Yeah, under the shadow of the British Empire and this devastating opium trade.
Exactly. It's 1838, and he shows how that moment really shaped so much of what came after. The detail is just incredible.
He definitely draws you in. But, you know, Ghosh's style, it's complex, that vast canvas, all those voices.
Mm.
It can be a challenge, right?
It can be, yeah. But I think that's also the reward. I mean, he's such a major figure in post-colonial literature.
Right, Indian writer, but also has that academic background, the anthropology PhD from Oxford.
Which you can really feel, that blend of meticulous history and this deep humanism. He uses what's called a polyphonic style.
So lots of different voices and perspectives woven together.
Exactly. And the language itself is amazing English mixed with Bhojpuri, Bengali, Hindi, slang from the time. It feels incredibly authentic.
And Sea of Poppies, this was 2008. First in the trilogy, got shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
That's right. And the setting, specifically 1838, is crucial. It's right before the first opium war.
The British basically started to force China to take their opium.
Pretty much, yeah. So the novel, it's like this literary excavation. It unearths these forgotten histories, indentured servitude, the sheer brutality of colonial economics.
Literary excavation, I like that. And the title itself, Sea of Poppies.
Oh.
Oh, that image hits you right from the start.
It does. Those plains near the Ganges, just covered in poppies, forced cultivation by the East India Company.
Beautiful, but sinister.
Utterly. And then you get the Ibis, the ship, a former slaver.
Right. And now it's carrying, well, a different kind of cargo.
Exactly. Indentured laborers, they called them grimitias, heading for the sugar plantations in Mauritius. And opium, of course, heading for China.
So the ship isn't just transport. It's something more.
Oh, absolutely. It becomes this floating microcosm of the whole empire. All the hierarchies, the exploitation crammed into one vessel.
And the central conflict. It's not just about getting from A to B.
Not at all. It's about survival, yeah. But also dignity, fighting back against colonialism, capitalism, even the Indian caste system, which gets sort of transplanted onto the ship.
Which raises that huge question, Gashik asking, if your old life, your old identity is just destroyed, can you build something new?
Can you forge new connections, a new destiny? And that idea of the Kalapani, the Blackwater, is so central here.
Crossing the ocean meant social death, especially for high caste Hindus.
Yeah.
Losing everything.
A terrifying prospect. But maybe, just maybe, also a chance for rebirth. A blank slate, in a way. And that's the backdrop for the characters we meet. Dieti, Neil, Zachary, Paulette. They're all swept up in this.
All brought together by loss, heading towards this ship.
Yeah.
So this Kalapani journey. What does it mean for these specific people? Let's meet them. Who are they really?
Okay, well, first there's Dieti. She starts as this pious, high caste woman in a village in Bihar. But her husband dies, addicted to opium, and she faces being forced onto his funeral pyre, Sati.
Horrifying.
It is. But she escapes dramatically with the help of Kalua. And this escape fundamentally changes her. She goes from this traditional village woman to becoming this incredibly strong, almost matriarchal figure on the Ibis. Her journey is about shedding that old constricting identity.
And Kalua, he helps her escape.
Yes, Kalua. He's from a very low caste, an oxman, they call him. Physically powerful, but very gentle. His bond with Dieti completely ignores caste rules. It's about loyalty, love, finding a new kind of family. He represents a break from the old social order.
A completely different world from someone like Raja Neil Ratanhalder.
Oh, completely.
Hmm.
Neil is this sophisticated, wealthy Bengali zamindar, an aristocrat. His story is tragic. He gets systematically ruined by the British colonial system.
Framed for forgery, wasn't he? By Benjamin Burnham, the merchant.
Precisely. He loses everything, his land, his status, his caste. His journey is about what's left when all those external markers are stripped away. It's incredibly painful to read.
And then you have Zachary Reed. He gives us a different view, right? The American sailor.
Yeah, Zachary's fascinating. He's mixed race, a quadroon, they called it then, one quarter black, but he's passing for white. He's ambitious, wants to get ahead in the British system.
So he's caught in the middle.
Absolutely. He sees the brutality of the hierarchy, but he's also tempted by the chance for promotion. He works for Burnham, becomes second mate on the Ibis. He's navigating this real moral gray area.
And Paulette Lambert, she's another outsider in a way.
Very much so. She's French, the orphan daughter of a botanist, but she grew up in India, speaks a Bhojpuri fluently. She completely rejects the stuffy European society, especially the idea of an arranged marriage.
So she wants out.
Desperately, she wants independence. So she disguises herself as an Indian woman to get aboard the Ibis with her childhood friend, Jodu. She represents this incredible cultural hybridity and a kind of quiet resistance.
Then there are the clear antagonists.
Benjamin Burner.
The owner of the Ibis, yeah.
Yeah.
He really embodies that colonial hypocrisy. Yeah. Outwardly, he's this devout Christian, very upright.
But he's making his fortune from the opium trade, ruining lives.
Exactly. Ruthless. And finally, there's Sarangali.
The head of the Indian sailors, the Lascars. Right. He's this really enigmatic figure. You don't know much about his past, but he commands incredible loyalty from the crew. He holds this sort of hidden subaltern power, and he turns out to be crucial later on.
It really is an incredible cast. So many different struggles converging on this one ship. And you mentioned the structure, land, river, sea. How does that shape the story?
It's fundamental. It mirrors their journey away from everything they knew. So part one, land. This is where we see their worlds falling apart.
Dieti's crisis in the village, the opium, the death, the threat of Sati, her escape with Kalua, their decision to sign on as Gurmitius.
Right. And Neil in Calcutta, his whole opulent life just collapsing, framed, sentenced, stripped of everything.
Zachary arriving, getting taken under Burnham's wing, becoming second mate, even getting kind of infatuated with Mrs. Burnham.
And Paulette planning her escape, rejecting marriage, getting ready to disguise herself. It's all set up.
Then part two, river. Everything starts moving, converging.
Yeah, the threads come together. Didi and Kalua join the other migrants heading for the ship. Neil is in prison, enduring that degradation. Paulette gets on board the Ibis in disguise. Zachary's trying to manage the chaos of loading the ship, facing the brutality of command.
That river journey feels like a transition zone, doesn't it? Leaving the solid ground behind for something else.
Exactly. A liminal space, like you said.
Mm.
Between the known world of land and the unpredictable world of the sea, old certainties are dissolving.
And then part three, sea, they set sail.
Into the Bay of Bengal. And life aboard the Ibis is stark. Rigid hierarchy, brutal conditions for the migrants and prisoners.
But new things start to happen too.
Yes. That's where the hope lies. Among the indentured workers, this new community forms. They start calling each other Jahajbai and Jahajbai, ship brother, ship sister.
Transcending caste and background?
Completely. And Didi becomes a real leader among them. Neil, too, starts changing, connecting with other prisoners like Afat. Paulette observes everything, still in disguise, and finds herself drawn to Zachary.
And Zachary's still caught in the middle.
Very much so. Caught between the cruel first mate, Mr. Crowell, and his own conscience, what little he allows himself to feel. There's friction there.
Until the climax, the storm.
Repelled by Saki. A violent cyclone hits the ship, and in the chaos, Sarangali sparks a mutiny. Neil, Afat, Jodu, others join in.
Moment of rebellion.
A desperate one. They manage to seize one of the longboats. Dieti, Kalua, Paulette, Neil, Afat, Jodu, Sarangali. They escape.
But escape to where?
Exactly. The book ends with them adrift. Free from the Ibis, but completely uncertain, lost on the ocean. It's a cliffhanger, but also powerful, that image of being adrift.
Wow. Yeah, adrift really sums it up. It's thrilling, yes, mm-hmm. But this book is doing so much more. It's tackling these massive themes that, frankly, still resonate today.
Absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, it's this devastating critique of colonialism and economic exploitation.
It lays bare the British Empire as this giant, ruthless business.
Totally. That sea of poppies image says it all, taking fertile land, forcing people to grow this destructive crop, all for profit. It connects the Indian farmer, the Chinese addict, the British merchant in this chain of misery.
And tied into that is the theme of identity, how it's stripped away, but also how it can be rebuilt.
Right. The Kalapani is social death, but maybe it's also a chance to reinvent yourself. Ghosh seems to ask if identity is something fixed or something you make, something you perform, especially under pressure.
You see that happening on the ship.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Which links to caste and social hierarchy. Ghost shows how the Indian caste system operates, its cruelties. But then on the Ibis, you see it start to break down.
With the Jahajbhai community.
Exactly. That's a radical challenge to the old order. People finding solidarity and shared suffering, regardless of their background. It's a fragile new world being born.
And the language itself feels like part of that. Kashi uses so many different languages, dialects.
Oh, the linguistic texture is incredible. English, Bhojpuri, Bengali, Hindustani, nautical pidgin. It's not just for show. It's about recovering those lost voices from history. And the way the characters create this sort of hybrid Ibis speak.
It's like they're building their own culture right there on the deck, a form of resistance.
Absolutely. It's a symbol of this new hybrid community forming against the odds.
It really feels like Ghosh isn't just telling a story. He's, I don't know, building this world brick by brick, using all these literary tools.
He absolutely is. The craft is masterful. He uses that third-person perspective, but shifts it around, giving you this panoramic, multi-voiced view. You see the world through Dieti's eyes, then Neil's, then Zachary's.
Which gives it that polyphonic quality you mentioned.
Yeah.
And the symbolism is so strong.
Everywhere. The Ibis itself, obviously. Linking past slavery to this new form of indentured labor. It's a prison, a workplace, a society, a pressure cooker.
A crucible for new identities.
Perfectly put. And the sea of poppies, that seductive beauty masking devastation. And Kalapani, the black water, being both this terrifying barrier and maybe a gateway to freedom, to rebirth.
You mentioned the language before, that linguistic innovation feels like a key technique too.
It is. Weaving in all those languages isn't just realistic. It actively recovers voices that history, written mainly in colonial English, often silenced. It immerses you.
The imagery is also so vivid. You can almost smell the opium, feel the heat of Calcutta, the cramped conditions on the Ibis, the violence of the storm.
He makes history tangible, visceral. You feel like you're there.
And his writing. Some lines just stick with you. They capture so much. Are there any quotes that really stand out for you?
Oh, definitely. That early description, the river of opium. It was as if a sluggish, gray-green river were flowing uphill, carrying with it the best of the soil's sap and richness.
That flowing uphill, it's so unnatural.
Exactly. It captures the perversity of the colonial economy, draining the life out of one place to enrich another. Just brilliant.
And what about the Girmitias, the indentured laborers?
There's that line. To be a Girmitia was to be a faceless, nameless phantom, a mysterious creature who had condensed out of the vapors of the Kalapani.
Wow. Faceless, nameless phantom. That captures the dehumanization, the loss of self.
Profoundly. Crossing the black water erased your past, made you almost spectral, but maybe also created something new from those vapors.
But then against that, you have Sarang Ali's idea.
Yes. His words about the Jahajbhai, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it's like, on a ship, sir, we are all Jahajbhai ship brothers. No Muslimman, no Hindu, no high caste, no low caste. The sea makes us equal.
That's the counter narrative, isn't it? The hope.
It's the core of the novel's hope, I think. That even in this floating prison, a new kind of kinship, a new equality can be forged, challenging everything.
And that leads to that almost prophetic line near the end.
What was happening was nothing less than the making of a new people, a new nation right here on the deck of the Ibis.
It's audacious. This idea that from the wreckage, something entirely new is being born.
It is. It's that vision of transformation, of community emerging from shared struggle right in the heart of displacement and oppression.
You know, finishing this book or even just talking about it like this, it leaves you with, well, a lot. It's deeply unsettling, but also kind of awe-inspiring.
It really is. The emotional impact is huge. You feel anger, real sorrow at the cruelty, the injustice of the opium trade, the personal tragedies, Dee losing her old life, Neil being destroyed.
Heartbreaking.
Truly. But then you also feel this incredible admiration for their resilience. Dee finding her strength, Neil finding a different kind of connection, Paulette fighting for her freedom.
And that creation of the Jahajbhai community, it feels genuinely triumphant.
Like an act of profound resistance and creation. And it really makes you reconsider the standard narrative of globalization, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Not just free trade and progress, but built on violence, addiction, coercion, forced migration.
Yeah. The book forces you to confront that uncomfortable history. And it makes you wonder, how much do those patterns of exploitation and displacement still echo in our world today? Whose stories still aren't being told?
So ultimately, Sea of Poppies feels like this powerful testament to human connection, to finding ways to resist even when everything seems stacked against you.
It reminds us that history isn't just about empires and wars, but about the small, often overlooked acts of courage and community by ordinary people caught in extraordinary times.
And just as a piece of writing, it's stunning. It shows what literature can do: recover lost histories, explore these deep ethical questions,
and connect the past to our present in ways that are both challenging and deeply moving. It really illuminates our interconnected world.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.